from WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. On today's show, we hear about the Prevention on the Go program from the Mary Bird Perkins Cancer Center. It seeks to bring treatment to residents in hard-to-reach areas. And we learn how a spike in the number of carbon monoxide-related deaths following Hurricane Ida led to a new requirement for detectors in homes. But first, nearly two decades ago, Louisiana lawmakers promised to reshape the state's juvenile justice system, calling for it to be a system that would rehabilitate youth rather than punish them. All these years later, though, youth facilities remain understaffed, underfunded, and violent. Here to tell us more about the broken promises of the juvenile justice system and where to go from here is Jacqueline DeRobertis, staff writer for the Baton Rouge Advocate. Jacqueline, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen. It's great to be here.
Jacqueline, tell us a little bit about what's going on in these youth detention centers right now. They're understaffed, underfunded. So how's that impacting the facilities and the kinds of environments there? What exactly is going on inside the prisons?
It's hard to speak to what is actually happening within the prisons on a day-to-day basis because, you know, access is extremely limited right now. What we do know is that there have been plenty of escapes from facilities like Bridge City Center for Youth in Jefferson Parish and incidents where staff members were injured, like at the Acadiana Center for Youth in Bunkie. Staff have testified at the legislature about being afraid for their safety, and the Office of Juvenile Justice Deputy Secretary has said there are not enough staff to manage these secure care facilities. Experts say that without enough staff that are adequately trained in OJJ's therapeutic model, there is more room for problems to escalate. And it's been said repeatedly over and over again for weeks now that the system is in crisis.
Well, you know, it was years ago that lawmakers made this pledge to have a gentler system focused on rehabilitation. Was anything at that time put in place to make that happen?
Yeah, so there were some provisions like closing a youth prison in Tallulah that had received national scrutiny and criticism. The Office of Juvenile Justice itself also became its own entity. It used to be housed under the Adult Corrections Department. So it really tried to focus on a rehabilitative model specifically tailored toward youth. Other efforts included ensuring kids had access to education and counseling. And I want to emphasize that some of this stuff is reportedly happening, and fewer kids than ever are being locked up than there were 20 years ago. But things have been tougher for those held in secure care facilities, which are basically youth prisons. The state contracted with the founder of something called the Missouri Model to implement Louisiana's version for these facilities called the Louisiana Model for Secure Care. At its core, this is a method that treats kids like kids, and it departs from a model of adult corrections. But Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, and of course, priorities shifted. Then budget cuts during Governor Bobby Jindal's administration made what was already going to be a complicated and difficult transformation even harder.
All righty. Well, you mentioned this Missouri model, and I know Louisiana surely could still learn some things from what Missouri's doing. Is there anything that Louisiana can implement, and does it give any hope for what the future holds?
Mark Stewart, who actually created the model, spoke at length with me for the story. The system he described that's happening in Missouri involves smaller regional facilities that keep kids close to their homes and allow families to stay involved. And there are plenty of reports of juveniles incarcerated at OJJ secure care facilities in Louisiana who have been transferred from center to center and even recently out of state to Alabama. Moving to these different environments breaks up the trust and stability formed at a single facility where they're supposed to be in these small groups that really encourage them to overcome whatever traumas they faced. As one formal official I spoke to told me, it seems like OJJ is doing the best they can right now, but things have spiraled so far out of control that it's hard to see a clear path forward.
Jacqueline DeRobertis is a staff writer for the Baton Rouge Advocate. Jacqueline, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Karen.
The Mary Bird Perkins Cancer Center in Baton Rouge is set to unveil a new mobile unit. This effort is meant to expand access to cancer screenings and preventive care while increasing healthcare options in the city. It's the latest edition of Mary Bird Perkins' Prevention on the Go program, which seeks to bring treatment to residents in hard-to-reach areas. Since the program's launch, there have been over 100,000 free cancer screenings throughout the Gulf South. here to tell us more about expanding access to cancer treatment and care is Renee Duffin, Mary Britt Perkins Vice President of Cancer Support, Outreach, and Clinical Research. Renee, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Well, tell us about this new mobile unit. Where is it going? Who will it serve? What kinds of tests and treatments will it offer?
Certainly. So for the past 20 years, Mary Britt Perkins has offered our Prevention on the Go program, which is a no-cost screening program and education program to the community. We have been offering breast, skin, prostate, colorectal, and oral cavity cancer screenings to individuals in 18 parishes in Southeast Louisiana, and we've expanded to 12 parishes in Northeast Louisiana. And we also serve five counties in Southwest Mississippi. We have done this heretofore through the use of two mobile medical clinics, and now we've added a third one to our fleet, and it's going to be a state-of-the-art facility that we'll be unveiling here very soon to the community that will enable us to continue to provide even more screenings in our local communities.
Now, I already mentioned 100,000 free cancer screenings throughout the Gulf South. That's already, I guess, with just those two units, you're expanding this. Can you tell us a little bit more about how successful just the two have been and what you're expecting as you add this third?
Certainly. So the two units have been covering a large swath of the state of Louisiana for us. And we have been able to diagnose over 800 cancers during that time. We have been averaging anywhere from 5,000 to 6,000 screenings per year. Approximately about 15% to 16% of those individuals that we screen on an annual basis have some type of abnormal finding. And so we are very unique in our program in that we don't just screen an individual and if something's wrong, we tell them good luck in trying to figure out what it is. We have a full-time nurse navigator who works with those individuals who have an abnormal finding, reach resolution to that finding. Many of the people that we see on our program are uninsured or underinsured. And so we help them navigate the healthcare system to find physicians and practices that will take them to help them reach resolution of any abnormal findings that they may have. And so that way that they are not left to try to figure it out on their own. So that makes our program very, very unique.
Now, as we mentioned, all this is part of the Prevention on the Go program. Tell us a little bit more about that program. When did it get started and what were the goals behind it?
So our board of directors here at Mary Britt Perkins had a vision back in the early 2000s, around 2002. Our cancer center was seeing a lot of late stage diagnosis, individuals coming in with stage 3 and 4 cancers. And so they wanted to address this problem of there are screening accessible cancers out there that if we were providing screening services for them, we could perhaps catch them earlier and those cancers can be defeated and cured. And so we wanted to be able to address that. So through the visionary work of our board of directors, we began offering these no-cost cancer screenings in 2002. And then in January of 2006, we put our first mobile clinic on the road. And so that enabled us to be able to go out more into the community and offer more cancer screenings. In 2013, we put our second mobile clinic on the road and we were able to expand our service area and include even more parishes. And so now with the addition of a third unit, we'll be able to do even more.
So you all have been out providing healthcare to hard to reach communities for more than a decade now and expanding with this for 20 years, so a couple of decades and expanding with a third unit. We are speaking with Renee Duffin, Mary Britt Perkins Vice President of Cancer Support, Outreach and Clinical Research. Now, Renee, often these units, again, as we've been talking about, travel to places. You know, often these units travel to places where people work, where they worship, where they shop. How do you decide exactly where these units will go and what's the purpose of offering screenings at some of these more intimate locations?
So we try to identify locations where we know we're going to have a lot of access to individuals that are in need. We have done community needs assessments that have drilled down to the zip code to try to identify where people may be experiencing barriers to care and health disparities. And so we try to go into those zip codes and we identify partners. And partners may be a local community center or it may be a local church, anywhere that can accommodate a mobile clinic, which is probably about a 50-foot mobile unit. And then our staff, as well as parking for our participants that come to our screening events. And we will go there. We also try to identify partners that are going to help us work on outreach and reaching the population that is in the community where we're going to be located. And those partners actually help us do a lot of grassroots outreach and spreading the word about the mobile clinic coming to their community and informing persons who may worship at their church or come to their community center. And so we go to those locations. We try to go to high traffic areas. So you may see us at in a Sam's parking lot or a Walmart parking lot, you know, as long as we can partner with those individuals to bring our units there. And the purpose for going into those communities, again, is access. You know, a lot of times we recognize that there are barriers to care that certain populations of people cannot overcome. And those include things like transportation barriers, financial barriers, health literacy barriers, language barriers even. And so we try to go into those communities and make people feel comfortable and safe that they don't necessarily have to go to a brick and mortar facility in order to get these services. It's kind of funny. Sometimes people will call and they'll say, well, I want to come and get a mammogram. Where are you going to be? And we'll tell them we're going to be in the Walmart parking lot. And they're like, wait, how am I getting a mammogram in the Walmart parking lot?
Yeah.
So it's very important to note that these are medical offices, but they're just on wheels. And also, we could not do this without the support of the community. We have a very strong philanthropic community in which we live and serve. And it's through the generosity of the community and grants and donations that we're able to provide this at no cost to individuals. And so we're very grateful for the donor community that supports our efforts to be able to bring this to local communities.
Renee, of course, I know the mobile screening unit isn't the only exciting new development to come out of Mary Bird Perkins Cancer Center. I understand that the center's recently opened a genetic services clinic. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. We all know that genetics is one of the causes of cancer. And so with precision medicine being what it is today and being able to provide treatments down to the genetic level, it's important that we understand what is the genetic makeup of individuals and their risk for cancers. And so we have brought on a genetics counselor and a team to be able to work with our patients to provide this service to our patient population and help them to help the physicians design and develop treatment protocols, especially for those patients.
And we also learned that the center will be expanding its clinical research program. Can you give us a little more information on that? What kinds of research will this expansion support?
Absolutely. We're very excited. We're going to be bringing in Dr. Vic Lin, who is a not only a medical doctor, but also a PhD, who will work with us with our clinical research program. And we will be able to expand the number of offerings that we have available for our patients in the clinical trial arena. Through our partnership with One Oncology, we're also going to be able to bring a lot more industry type clinical trials to our community, more phase two, phase three type clinical trials, so that individuals can have access and exposure to those in helping to enable them to have much, much better treatment outcomes and better quality of life.
Well, for anyone listening who wants to learn when a mobile clinic will be coming to them, or who perhaps wants to request that a clinic come to their neighborhood, what can they do?
They can go to our website and see all of our screenings that are available and where they where the mobile clinics will be. In addition to that, they can call us at 225-215-1234, and we'll be happy to schedule an appointment for them.
We've been talking with Renee Duffin, Mary Britt Perkins, Vice President of Cancer Support, Outreach, and Clinical Research. Renee, thanks again for being here.
Thank you for having us.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. They're stacked high in store aisles in preparation for the flood of customers looking for a power source should the lights go out during a storm. Generators are in much demand as we head into the busiest part of hurricane season. The state fire marshal's office is warning, though, if you buy a generator, be sure to also pick up a carbon monoxide detector. A spike in the number of carbon monoxide-related deaths after Hurricane Ida prompted a Louisiana lawmaker to author legislation making CO detectors a requirement at homes. That requirement's now state law. It goes into effect January 1st. Here to talk about generator safety is State Fire Marshal Dan Wallace and author of that new law, Metairie Representative Stephanie Hilferty. Thank you both for coming on today.
Thanks for having us, Karen.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Representative Hilferty, this legislation was personal for you. It's birthed out of an experience you and your family had last year during Hurricane Ida. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. During the middle of the night, a few days into Hurricane Ida, I was staying at my mother-in-law's house, which does have a whole home generator. My husband and I, he thought to bring our plug-in carbon monoxide detector from our house. We plugged it in and very early in the morning, a few days into that generator having been running, you know, day after day, the alarm sounded. So we knew to, at that point, get out of the house to assess the conditions and check the levels within the house. Had we not taken that alarm, my mother-in-law at the time did not have a carbon monoxide detector in her house, despite having a whole home generator. And then in talking to people and in talking to our former state fire marshal, Butch Browning, I realized that there are several homes that have a whole home generator and do not have a carbon monoxide detector, which is when we started looking into and thinking about this legislation, which we ran in the 2022 legislative session.
You mentioned you got with former state fire marshal Butch Browning to create the legislation. I know it doesn't go into effect until January 1st of next year, but it's not a bad idea to get a jump on safety, especially as we head into the busiest time of hurricane season. Can you tell us about the new legislation? What's in the new law?
Sure. So the new law is that any existing one or two family dwelling at the time of a sale or a lease, so when that property is transferring, whether it be to a new owner or to a new tenant, that unit or house would have a operable carbon monoxide detector with a long life sealed battery installed at that time. And it may be a combination smoke detector and carbon monoxide detector. Those are fairly common. Additionally, if a generator is professionally installed at that time, a carbon monoxide detector also has to be installed.
Fire Marshal Wallace, I know every year your office puts out a list of generator tips. I know having a carbon monoxide detector in your home is right there at the top of that list.
Absolutely.
What are some of the other tips?
Yes, absolutely. Carbon monoxide detection is extremely important, and we appreciate all of the hard work that's gone into passing this legislation. But so many people think that when they have the professionally installed generators, then the hazard goes away, but certainly not. The hazard does not go away. First of all, it has to be installed by a reputable licensed contractor to install those generators. And they have to be installed based on the manufacturer's specifications in regards to where they're placed, how far from the home, such, how far are they from the neighbor's home. Sometimes we don't think about that. And so once they're installed and they run and they operate, you know, many times these things operate for days and days. And our recommendation is that, you know, after 5 or 6 hours of use, give the generator rest, turn the generator off. If in fact there are levels of carbon monoxide that's built up in the home that maybe hasn't set the detector off yet, open the windows, air things out, give the generator a break, and then crank it back up later on.
Well, I did see the statement from the health department. For just 2021, CO poisoning, 81 Louisiana residents died from carbon monoxide poisoning. That's such a high number and a shocking number. And, you know, that's just in last year. And they, I'm seeing here from the health department, there were, of those 81 deaths, 6 of the deaths occurred during Hurricane Ida. And so this is a life-saving type of information that we're getting out here as we speak with you, Fire Marshal Wallace, and with you, Representative Hilferty. What other tips and information do you have as people have whole house generators, as in that situation, or as you mentioned, the little portable ones?
Even if they're installed with the factory recommendation installation procedures, things affect the carbon monoxide, the humidity that's outside, the wind direction, and things of that sort. And so even though it's installed with best practices, it's not fail safe. But what is fail safe is a carbon monoxide alarm. And that's why we think that the carbon monoxide alarm is the first and the primary method of protection from this carbon monoxide. Now, to the portable generators, you know, some of the same principles apply. We have to keep those generators a safe distance away from the house. And we do recommend that you don't put the generator in any enclosed spaces and you have adequate ventilation. And taking it to extreme levels, you know, I personally have a portable standby generator and take it to the point that we put it away from the home and we plug an industrial fan to blow the carbon monoxide fumes away from the home, because I've seen the devastating effects of carbon monoxide.
Now, what do you do though if the alarm goes off? I'm thinking like a fire alarm, you vacate the premises, number one. But what steps do you take once that's happened?
Absolutely. The priority is get out, is to get out of the house. Carbon monoxide actually displaces the oxygen in the body. And as Representative Hilferty was saying, you know, some of the initial, if you're awake, so initial is you may just feel weak. You won't smell it. You won't see it, but you'll have a different type feeling. But if the alarm goes off, the priority is get out of the house, open and try to ventilate windows, leave the doors open as you leave. Turn the generator off.
And Representative Hilferty, I mean, you can jump in. Yeah, that happened in your home.
Sure. As you said, the alarm went off very early in the morning. Let's call, you know, the middle of the night. There was a fence around the generator that was really, it was a solid fence. It was kind of trapping in that carbon monoxide coming from the generator. And we believe it was actually going perhaps under the house and then coming up through the floorboards. But I want to just mention to people, you know, as you're taking stock of, you know, hurricane supplies, right now is a great time to go out and get that carbon monoxide detector for your house. These are inexpensive, life-saving pieces of equipment. A lot of these deaths have occurred outside of storm events. So this is something that'll, you know, protect your family year round.
I'd like to thank you both for joining us today. State Fire Marshal Dan Wallace, Metairie Representative Stephanie Hilferty. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us, Karen.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Thanks to our guests, reporter for the Baton Rouge Advocate, Jacqueline DeRobertis, Mary Bird Perkins, Vice President of Cancer Support, Renee Duffin, State Fire Marshal Dan Wallace, and State Representative Stephanie Hilferty. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. Our digital editor is Caitlin Omholtz. Our engineers are Garrett Pittman, Aubrey Purcell, and Thomas Walsh. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7:30 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from the Historic New Orleans Collection.